add up the pennies and the pounds will take care of themselves, my granny used to say.
Whoops, I guess granny didn't hear. No pennies anymore. Stephen Harper cut those too. But we'll take nickels, we'll take dimes, we'll take loonies and toonies and $5 bills and $50 bills and even $100 bills.
You can donate at rabble.ca/donate.
Rabble.ca/donate. Every little bit or every large bit helps.
This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
The key thing about the Commons and the notion of reclaiming it is we're reclaiming responsibility for habitat, social and natural. A lot of young people are getting involved in lots of grassroots stuff. And what the Commons framework does is allows them to see that they are reviving a lost heritage, something that has incredible historical legitimacy.
Hello and welcome to Habitat. I'm your host, Erica Butler, here with you for the next hour of conversations about how we live in our environment. My guest today on Habitat is Heather Menzies, prolific author. She's releasing a new book called Reclaiming the Commons for the Common Good, a memoir and manifesto. She's having some events next week. And we're gonna ask her a bit about her book, get a little sneak preview of some of the ideas she explores in that. But you should all head out to the Nova Scotia Museum of Natural History on Tuesday, June 3rd at 7 p.m. to hear Heather Menzies talk about her book. She also has some other events, which we'll get to later in the show. Then we're going to, following the theme of Heather's book, we're going to actually revisit a tour we took of the Common Roots Urban Farm last summer. The Common Roots Urban Farm is in full swing right now. You can see gardeners, you know, dozens and dozens of community gardeners buzzing about the site all the time these days. And there's lots of workshops happening at Common Roots. We'll hear about some of those as well. But first, reclaiming the commons for the common good. Heather Menzies is author of a new book, Reclaiming the Commons for the Common Good, a memoir and manifesto. The Halifax launch is happening Tuesday, June 3rd at 7 p.m. at the Nova Scotia Museum of Natural History. Heather Menzies, thanks for joining us on Habitat.
My pleasure.
Can you tell us a bit about the genesis for this book, Reclaiming the Commons for the Common Good?
Sure. Basically, I was at a dead end. I'd been writing books and giving speeches about the shift to the online world. I had kind of named the problem, an increasingly dysfunctional global economy on a collision course with an increasingly distressed planet kind of thing. And I had the analysis down pat, but I had no solution. And rather, I didn't feel that I was grounded in what I was for, only what I was against. And so I felt the need to go off totally into the dark, totally into the unknown. And what was interesting was I got this notion of going to check out my ancestral roots in the Highlands of Scotland. And when I told an Ojibwe friend of mine, Bev Lubjik in Ottawa, she said, "Oh, you're going to welcome your ancestors back." And it had never occurred to me that there might be some kind of a conversation that had broken off somewhere some generations back that I could pick up on. And that's what inspired me to go back. And what I found was that, in fact, my ancestors had lived on the commons in the Highlands. These are self-organizing, self-governing, do-it-yourself social organization. And what's neat about it is that it's community and land together. And suddenly, I felt found. I had found a place to ground myself. The commons as an alternative to the state running things and giving it over to a corporate agenda, or the corporations running things and giving it all over to investors' bottom lines.
Mm-hmm. So, in the idea being that it's not, we're not just splitting up everything into small little separate parcels, and handing it out to society, but we're actually sharing our resources.
Yeah, I think when you talk about parceling out, I think what's useful to understand is, like, for instance, we have the House of Commons today, and there are all these different constituencies. Well, the original constituency, it was in fact the Commons. And there was no, this is the Commons originates out of, in fact, kind of tribal homelands. It's a natural evolution from hunter-gatherer society as it moves towards a hunter-farmer society. And that's what my people did in the Highlands of Scotland. And the clan-based system had a lot of parallels to the clan system of the First Nations people. So to take it into the modern way of thinking, what you would have is self-governing commons, self-governing communities nested within larger frameworks in which you would have agreement on overarching principles. But the key thing about the commons and the notion of reclaiming it is we're reclaiming responsibility for habitat, social and natural. And then as a lot of young people are getting involved in lots of grassroots stuff. And what the commons framework does is allows them to see that they are reviving a lost heritage, something that has incredible historical legitimacy, but then also being able to see that it is the smallest unit in something that then can be scaled up, but in terms of governance. And they also can feel affirmed that they are learning the skills and gaining the confidence that they need to be able to think for themselves, speak up for themselves, organize what needs to be done, identify what policy needs to be brought to the larger political agendas, and then having that local-based community, whatever they're involved in. I mean, it could be the Common Roots Urban Farm in Halifax. It could be the Friends of the Halifax Common, or it could be the Council of Canadians, because they are a very self-organizing kind of organization, with the local chapters having a lot of autonomy. Out of that kind of collective agency, we can make a lot of things happen. We can reclaim the commons of the larger planet.
A lot of people, I mean, are familiar with the Halifax Common. Mostly it's considered a park. That's sort of what the common land has become now.
Yeah. People think of it mostly just as land. They don't think of it as, in fact, a governance unit, but that's how we need to understand it. If we're going to be able to wrest control back into literally the community and citizens, as opposed to the municipal government or developers. I mean, right now you've got, what do you have on it? You have hospital, schools, you have different public institutions, and that's fine. But what I can't remember which King George it was, who allocated that land, a vast amount of land, most of which has been disappeared, but that original parcel of land was for the people of Halifax in perpetuity. And the original concept of the commons is that we common together. Commons is really a verb form, and that's the best way to understand it. How are we going to common together in common purpose out of this habitat? And right now you've got the remnant of the original commons that was set there, but the whole bioregion of Halifax can be seen as a potential commons as people reclaim responsibility for the common good that is both social and the natural habitat. So out of it could be, you know, the commoning dynamic can inspire young people who are into food production to create more food co-ops, people into housing. It can inspire them to create housing co-ops. Maybe people getting involved in alternative forms of hydropower can organize in the form of creating essentially municipal levels of solar power, tidal power, wind power. The important thing is the self-governance, local self-organizing, and let's do it, but taking responsibility to do it together.
When you discovered this about your Scotland ancestors, what sort of, like, how did these self-governing units work for them at that time? What did it look like?
Frankly, Erica, I had to imagine my way back into it because I read a whole lot. There's been some very, very good recent research reclaiming stuff out of local archives, piecing together what this was all about. One of the big things I did was I combined all that research with walking the land, because literally I was able to get to the ruins of a commons hamlet where my great-great-great-grandfather was born in 1792. I was able to dig in the dirt, and so as I dug in the dirt, the phrase came back to me that they used to use at the time, a field in good heart. And as I dug in the dirt and as I thought about these kind of things that I'd encountered in my research, I was able to begin to feel how these people related to the land. They were inhabitants of a land, and they their whole lives depended on working out a workable relationship so that the community would be sustained and so would the land. And so partly it was intuiting, partly it was imagining. I encountered, for instance, a beautiful account of when the people who were elected at commons meetings, and that's very similar to the Occupy movement's general assemblies, direct democracy, when people would gather at these commons meetings at pubs or public houses, they would elect field officers to be responsible, for instance, for making sure that everybody observed the regulations on only so many sheep to be sent to the upland pasture, for instance, or you can only farm in this infield strip. When this field officer would take the oath of office, he would take his shoes and his socks off, stand barefoot in the field, pick up a clump of dirt, hold it over his heart, and take basically the oath to be true to both the people and the land. And so I would walk these fields, I'd stand in the fields, I'd have the dirt in my hands, and it was as though the voices of the spirits of my ancestors were calling me back to an understanding of how people lived immersed. They were implicated in the welfare of the land and the community. And it was out of that the governance emerged. People, their daily lives were immersed in having to adhere to what was good for everyone and for the land. And they internalized kind of the logic of it, that they internalized these values and they held their natural inclinations towards selfishness and greediness in check. And it was the dailiness of this being immersed in all the commoning activities, because people did a lot of stuff together, you know, driving the sheep to the upland pastures, fixing the fences together. So much activity was done together that it helped to bind them into a sense of community and the common good.
How much of that practice and that I guess especially strong, I don't know, spiritual sense that was attached to how they were operating, how much of that made it, you know, to a place like Halifax where the people who set up the commons were largely settlers?
Yeah, very good question, Erica. I think a lot of it did persist. And when you say the spiritual, there was a spiritual element in terms of Celtic Christianity and that notion that the creator or the divine was imminent in all of creation. And so there was a celebration of life and its gift in all the kinds of activities that people did, from milking cows to bringing in the grain. I can't speak to Nova Scotia and Halifax, but one of my books was it's called By the Labor of Their Hands, The Story of Ontario Cheddar. And I researched the history of rural Ontario and how the people who came over from Scotland at the time of the clearances, and basically the commons in the highlands, some of the highland glens, like where my ancestors came from, which is, you know, very much the somewhat remote from modern development, capitalist development and stuff. The commons persisted, and so they brought many of their self-organizing, self-governing practices with them. And in Upper Canada, they set up township meetings, and they set up agricultural societies where they shared knowledge from their experience. And they also set up the cooperatives like the farmer-owned cheese factory cooperatives. And this ethos of the common good, this spiritual aspect, really did prevail there in these practices. From some of the old people that I was able to interview who were associated with the last of the farmer-owned cooperatives before they were all taken over or done in by various forms of regulation, these people spoke to that very sense of the common good. So it did persist, but so much of the modern way of thinking, everything is individualized, everything is turned into a commodity, and so the capacity for working together, working things out together, and sharing and cooperating has been seriously undermined. And that's why part of what I talk about is reclaiming the commons, is reclaiming our capacity to common and our capacity to feel that the common good can prevail.
Yeah, it reminds me of, even to a certain extent, you know, when you talked about the person elected taking the clump of dirt to their heart, reminds me of the idea of even treating the land or the earth or just the natural world as, you know, a real player in everything that we're doing. Like it goes along with the rest of us. It reminds me of recent conversations about the green rights movement and the movement to recognize the natural world as having rights just like the rest of us, which is sort of a big, I thought it was a big shift philosophically from what I see around me and how we sort of organize ourselves now. That whole idea of really recognizing that there's something real.
Yeah. I find myself shifting from the language of rights, which is all about individualizing and separating.
Right.
To the language of responsibility. So I offset, you know, like right now we've got the triumph of corporate rights and you've got investor rights and all that kind of thing. The counterweight to that is not the rights of the environment. It's our shared responsibility, for community and commons, or rather the habitat, social and natural. The manifesto section of the book begins very small and very intimate and very simple. It says, go for a walk, get involved, begin to implicate yourself in whatever bit of habitat is your home area. It could be a neighborhood, could be a piece of park. As you start to enter a relationship with this habitat, so it comes alive to you, and to use your language, you're aware of it as a player.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not a player that is over there having rights. It is a player in which you're beginning to form a relationship. You become more attentively aware of what its needs are, what its ebb and flows are, and your ability to respect and recognize it as an agent build as you interact, and particularly if you do things with other people, because I talk about, okay, go on from just going for walks, neighborhood walks, joining in things like biomapping and asset mapping to gardening projects and other commoning projects. And all of these are ways in which you begin to ground yourself in the real living world, and that's what's real. And as we ground ourselves there, we can begin to really not only identify the policies we need for healthy living for our children, for each other, healthy groundwater, and therefore why we have to be against fracking, we can find the sense of solidarity with each other and with that land that will allow us to do the work we have to do.
What are some of the, you mentioned Occupy and the style of organizing that Occupy movements had all over North America. Where else do you see this sort of this rebirth of this, I guess, respect for the commons or understanding or engagement in the commons?
What I'm doing, Erica, is actually putting the frame around it, because I'm inviting people to see a lot of efforts where they think they're inventing the wheel for the first time, allowing them to see that, oh, this fits into this larger framework. And so here I'm doing some do-it-yourself. I mean, you're seeing some very interesting initiatives in what we can call loosely the labor movement, you know, these flash mobs, these people, instances where people are seizing the moment to say, this is not fair, and this is what is fair, and we're standing up for it. And then you're seeing a lot of direct action around creating community for people who, young people, for instance, who can't get decent jobs, can't afford to live on their own. That you can be, you can understand that as commoning. And so what I'm inviting people to do is honor what they're doing and then understand the kind of capacity building that they can continue to do. What kind of policy do you need to be exploring here? And this is where organizations like the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, which is one of the sponsors for the speech I'll be giving, this is the role it can play, helping to create fora where people can identify where are there regulatory obstacles to commoning, to cooperative action, and there are lots, because there's so much that is now where there's bias towards it has to be a corporation, it has to be based on share, you know, the not necessarily stock market, but capitalization. And then, as I was mentioning, I'm encouraging people to think of local chapters of organizations like the Council of Canadians, to think of that as a self-governing commons, and how can we build on, how can we do other projects? Because the key to commoning is people self-organize into work teams, it's leadership from within, and so you have constantly the affirmation of agency, individual and collective. And that's where, that's the big thing I'm trying to say is, this is the heritage we can reclaim.
So you've got some events happening in Halifax next week. I mentioned at the Nova Scotia Museum of Natural History on Tuesday, June 3rd, 7 p.m.
Mm-hmm. That'll be the main event, 7 to 9. Books will be available there, plus a music CD. We didn't even talk about this, but that's a singer-songwriter friend of mine did a music a series of songs based on the memoir part of my book, which is all about going back and reconnecting with the land and feeling as though I'm in touch with the spirits of my ancestors. It's lots of fun. So that's the one on Tuesday, June 3rd, 7 to 9 at the museum. And then actually on Monday, there's another speaking event. This will be on the South Shore. And this will be at Mahone Bay Center at 454 School Street, Mahone Bay, Monday the 2nd at 7:30. So that starts a little later.
Okay, all right.
And then, in fact, in the afternoon of June 2nd, there's going to be a community picnic, Park Avenue Oven Community Picnic Supper.
In Dartmouth?
In Dartmouth, that's right.
Yeah. That's 3:30 to 6?
3:30 to 6.
Okay, thanks very much, Heather Menzies, and we hope everyone can make it out to those events.
It's been a pleasure talking to you, Erica.
Thanks very much, Heather.
You're very welcome.
All right.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That's Old Man Ludicky with I'm a Rich Man. You're listening to Habitat on CKDU 88.1 FM, habitatradio.ca, or the Rabble Podcast Network. Coming up next, we're going to take an audio tour of the Common Roots Urban Farm to give you a taste of what the farm was like last summer in the height of growing season. Here is the audio tour I took last year with Jamie Melrose, who is the garden coordinator.
My name is Jamie Melrose, and I'm the project coordinator for Common Roots Urban Farm. Okay, so we're at our shed. I'm really proud because I cleaned it yesterday. We got a really big donation of books, and so that's great. So the staff can research things and look in on the books, which is great because we have lots of youth, or a couple of youth, that are working at the farm, and so I love encouraging them to go look it up. So here, that's our shed full of tools, and now we're getting to the compost station.
The shed is mostly locked, but then you have tools outside for people to use.
Yeah,
whenever they need
exactly.
Them.
The shed's open when the staff are here, and every day between 3 and 6, so that the plotters and everyone can get into it. Otherwise, it's locked. But yeah, there is a big thing of tools that people just use. Yep. Okay, so then we get into the compost station here, and our compostmeister is turning the compost right now. That's Dr. Jason Hoffman. He's got a PhD. We love him. Mm-hmm. And so this is his little station. So the gray bins are where you dump the compost. He's got a little chalkboard up with his messages for people. And then you can see he's got a machete and this giant chopping block, because he chops all the, everything that goes in there gets chopped to bits. And then you can see this big horseshoe. And so this is where, this is his strategy. He puts the, he puts his inputs in the middle, and in this way he can stand in one place and distribute everything in the compost. So he like layers it on horizontally, and then he turns it vertically as he goes around. And this four-legged contraption here is his compost screener, so that all the finished products can get screened all finely and lovely. And the other lockbox over there is the worm bins. So he started out with a handful of worms, and now he's got 4 worm bins on the go. Yeah.
Red wigglers?
Yeah, they're urban cows. Legal urban cows. Yeah, I think he's got a bunch of kinds. How many kinds of worms do you have in there?
Two.
Red wigglers and European night crawlers. The European night crawler is a bigger worm. It's actually a forest worm originally. And it just looks like a bigger version of the red wiggler. They work together really well. The red wigglers tend to be surface feeders, and the European night crawlers will go down lower. So they work well together.
So they basically sort of really speed up.
Oh yeah, they do. They do. There's no better test indicating compost quality than the amount of worms that show up in it. You know, and when they're all done, they leave. You know, so and this whole site here now is all, you're standing on worms right now. So put down compost and they just head for it.
Yep. We're slowly training people. Training each other on sorting things into the right piles, which is so much of what gardening is about, actually, is like, you know, pull the rocks and the dirt and the leaf matter out, put it all back together in the right order.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, in a community garden, I've often found that people have very different ideas sometimes. The gardening is, I feel like gardeners are like economists. None of them really agree necessarily all the time on everything. Have you had any sort of, well, I guess you have just communication issues, just making sure people know how the group has decided how it should work.
Yeah. And so we've got a few communication mechanisms. There's the bulletin boards and the binder. And so I guess those are the sites where those sort of things arise.
Yeah.
But the market garden is run by the farmer, and so she's the boss.
She makes the decisions.
Yeah. And the edible landscaping is run by me, so I get to make those decisions. And then the plots are to each their own. And so I feel like it's in the community plots where there's like, this is my gardening style that, you know, this is, mm-hmm. and then, but whatever, go for it. Fly at it, you guys. We'll all just check you out.
Yeah. Sounds good. All right.
Yep. Okay, so we've got plots here. So you can see that they're an amazing array and variety of everything. Some of them are like insanely, hugely productive.
Yeah.
And others of them are very humbly but beautifully productive. And others of them haven't quite taken off so well. So,
how many different community plots are there?
There's 119 plots.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a big, big garden.
That is a lot of, yeah. And I think that there's 82, like, groups or people. Because some people have one, some people have two.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. This is our little drainage trench, because the drainage on site is terrible. This site looks like a field or a meadow, but it is a demolition site, and it doesn't drain. So it's better to think that we're on a parking lot with grass on top of it. Mm. That's the way it acts, like ecologically.
Really?
Yeah, which is interesting. Okay, so to our left here, so we're standing near the main pathway and we're looking over towards emergency. And right now it doesn't look like too much. But next week, I think that this big main path is going to start to get to be made wheelchair accessible. So we have a donation of the materials and a donation of the labor. And I'm just so excited. There's just so many people in wheelchairs around here.
Mm-hmm.
So to make this accessible is going to be
awesome.
And you
guys have some raised beds.
Yeah, exactly.
That could be gardened by people in wheelchairs.
They're designed to be gardened by people in wheelchairs. Yeah. And then also, the kinsmen have donated money for us to build a shade structure so that fragile populations can sit in the shade. So within the next month or so, this area in here is going to really be quite changed to be more amenable to the hospital mm-hmm. populations.
Right. It's very near the hospital entrance, so
exactly.
people will be able to come out and enjoy.
Exactly. It's been very interesting to be situated so close to emergency. Emergency, as you can imagine, has like a multitude of dramatic scenes yeah. occurring around it. Yeah, okay, so... yeah, this area here is the Fisker's garden. This was a big corporate gift. And so it includes the wheelchair accessible beds and a little bit of shade. And I definitely do notice that a lot of the hospital population, visitors and patients and staff, are coming out and using the space regularly, which is awesome.
You got a picnic table, some shade for people to sit under.
Yeah.
Some chairs.
Exactly.
Benches.
Some things to nibble on. We got hazcaps and hazelnuts in this bed here.
Oh, the hazcaps.
I know. Yeah.
So people, and these are nibble plots,
yep.
which here means basically anyone can wander through and nibble.
Exactly. Fly at her.
All right.
Yeah. Okay, and so then when we turn towards the Atlantica Hotel, then these big fluffy beds on either side of the main pathway, these are also edible landscaping. And so these are fair game. There's parsley and strawberries and gooseberries and different herbs and daylilies, things that people can nibble on. And they're just sort of these big, big fluffy buffers. Mm.
Is everything edible?
Not everything. Okay. No, it's a mixture.
I wondered about that.
It's a mixture of edible and ornamental, native and exotic. It's just kind of the free-for-all. Yeah, edible landscaping doesn't necessarily mean that it is all...
Food.
Yeah.
For people.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. It's food for something.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so then when I look out... this way, then we see these big long beds that all have the same crops in them. So we can see three cucumber beds with their little low tunnel things, and then tomatoes and peas and beans. And so this is the market garden. So this is our main programming site where we can host groups to do educational volunteering. And so Sarah Burgess is our farmer, and she's already, well, as of last week, she had produced about 150 pounds of food that was taken to the food bank, and most of that was salad mix.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, like, that is a lot of salad mix. And so she rides the bike and trailer down to the Parker Street Food Bank and brings them this big delivery of fresh organic, organically grown, not certified organic, produce every week. And so I know that this week she harvested cucumbers, so I would imagine that number just went up dramatically.
Is Sarah working for the garden?
Yes.
She's a paid farmer.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you guys are able to donate all that food to the Parker Street Food Bank?
Yeah. And so we're trying to do that through a food bank CSA. And so we're just launching this as a fundraiser. And so it's like a CSA where we're doing community supported agriculture. But if you buy a share, you don't get the food. The food goes to the food bank. It is something that has social value, right? This space has social value, the education has social value, and the food going to the food bank has social value. So I'm hoping that there are related individuals and businesses that are happy to invest in the value that is here.
So when you say educational value, you... groups will come in and Sarah will explain or help
show them
what she's doing with the market garden, share some of her knowledge.
Yep, exactly. Exactly. So there's quite a number of groups that come weekly. And so that's awesome. They get such a chance to see how food is grown. And we've had a dietetic intern helping do a bunch of cooking with us on the farm. So people are getting that chance to see the seed to plate. But then there's also a lot of groups that come just once, and I think even just that opportunity to see food growing and to see how things grow and start to get a bit of a sense of the work that goes into that food and taste test, like, what really fresh, healthily grown food tastes like. And that's value. It's got lasting impact. We also have a lot of volunteers that are just coming on their own accord and coming regularly. Partly for the skill building and also partly for the social.
When did you guys start this?
I think it was 3 years ago now. I think it was in about November or December of 2010. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That would be the planning started for it, I guess.
The planning started then, and it started with a community engagement session. Mm-hmm. They harvested a lot of the public ideas as to what people wanted to see here, and then formed the business plan from that place. So we tried to incorporate as much of that as we could, and some of it we've got already, not all of it, of course. That'll take a little bit. Yeah. So I'm walking us over to where the cold frames are. There's only one now. But we're going to try and build a couple more tomorrow. I got a little bit of grant money through the local food fund to build some cold frames and do some season extension stuff so that we can grow crops later and earlier in the year. And then there's more community plots. And then we've got a new structure on site, which was finished last week, and that is through the Dalhousie School of Architecture Free Lab. Josh Collins was the leader of that free lab, and 8 students built that little structure so that we could display some of our information and help draw some community in.
And then down the hill towards the Willow Tree intersection is some... your orchard.
Yeah. Yeah.
And more than just an orchard, we're doing a food forest, which is using some of the permaculture principles, particularly of imitating natural systems and looking at how trees are part of a community, and that there's certain... Bye, Jason. Certain main community segments, such as nitrogen fixers, dynamic accumulators, insectary plants, and mulch plants. And so looking to put together these really intentional communities of plants that are mutually beneficial. So we've got some fruit and nut trees down there now, and we're looking to expand that a bit with native and non-native companion plants at their base. Yeah.
Can we take a walk back to just check out the compost tea apparatus?
Oh, yeah,
is that
totally.
Still, is that still gurgling away?
Yeah, it is.
You've got a rainwater collection system here too by the shed?
Yeah, we do. It's we often need to supplement it with tap water because our roof is so small, but it is a really good example of, I can't remember how the weight, but I think it's, I don't know if there's 1 ton of water there or half a ton of water, but there's a lot of water in those big blue barrels.
For big blue barrels, it's one,
yeah,
almost five big
exactly.
blue barrels can be filled up.
Exactly.
With just one tiny little roof.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And they're all connected together at the bottom. And then that clear plastic tube that comes up, that's our measuring gauge. So we can always see how much water is in there. And so we've done it really inexpensively using boat parts. They're called through hulls. And so we've just used those. We have found that they can break fairly easily. But, I mean, one of those little plastic through hulls is only $5. And it lasts basically for the season. So pretty inexpensive water collection strategy. Mm-hmm. We are thinking about getting a big underground cistern. The School of Engineering has offered to help us design a bike-powered water pump.
Oh, interesting.
Which would be amazing.
Yeah.
Be amazing. I would love to see more bike-powered machinery up there, up here.
Okay. I guess the cistern would not be as movable as these blue barrels are.
Yeah, that's kind of the thing. I would imagine we could move it, but it's definitely a pretty big investment of labor. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, so we're at the compost tea brewer, and it would be great to have Jason here to talk to us about it, because he's the one who built this, designed and built it. Compost tea is not for humans, it's for plants. And it's really helpful to think of it as a soil probiotic. So you know how, like with our stomachs, we have a whole metropolis of creatures in our bellies that help us digest food. All sorts of bacteria and enzymes and little things in there. So plants and soil are the same. Plants don't eat dirt. They're fed by the little creatures. Bacteria and fungi and nematodes and protozoa and rotifers. And there's another one whose name I can't remember. And we're going to start to do open microscope evenings here with Jason. So he's going to make nematode traps and show us some of these little creatures that support the web of life. They're the bottom of the web of life. They take all the complex molecules and break them all down and repackage them up into plant food. So those little creatures love oxygen. Oxygen equals healthy. No oxygen equals rot. So this contraption keeps spinning and the water comes down and then up and the main aeration happens in these side tubes. Mm. Yeah, so it is...
It's brewing.
It's brewing.
Bubbling.
And one of the things that's cool about our batch is that it's just ongoing, so that the population just keeps like building and building and building. Mm. So we've got a lot of not only the short-term things like bacteria, but we've got more of the long-term creatures in here.
And is this in, used on the market garden?
Yeah.
Edible landscaping.
Exactly, pots? Yeah. Sarah puts it in her backpack sprayer and sprays it out, I think, every week.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right. Anything else that you want to point out or share about?
The farm's open every day from 3 to 6. There's friendly people here, give you a tour and show you what daylilies you can eat.
You can eat daylilies.
You can. Have you not eaten a daylily?
No.
Oh,
can
let's go eat a daylily. Yeah, I think most people know that they can eat nasturtiums, which are those spicy flowers over there. But you can also eat daylilies, and we tend to grow so many daylilies here in Nova Scotia, I guess because they grow really well.
Mm-hmm.
But they only bloom for one day.
Right.
And then the flower just turns into like this like wilted dry thing. So it makes sense to eat them. And I just think they taste like flower flavored lettuce. Mm. And so you can be a lady and pull a petal off one at a time if you like, but
let's throw it in. All right. I'm gonna pick one.
Mm-hmm. Check for earwigs. Always check for earwigs.
That's excellent advice.
Yeah.
Okay, modeled mm-hmm. after Jamie Melrose.
Gosh.
I know.
Wow.
They're so, and that's the sweet part right there, that little end.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
I know, isn't it? It's like sweet, flowery lettuce.
What a revelation.
Yeah. If you don't eat them, they're just going to fall off.
Mm-hmm. Delicious.
Oh, yeah. Snacks. Snack food.
Yep.
No.
Amazing.
The different colors taste slightly different, so I do suggest a
sampling.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing. Mm-hmm. Well, who knew that those were vegetables?
Who knew, indeed?
Yep.
Thank you so much for your time.
Great. Thanks.
All
thanks,
right.
Erica.
Yeah. Enjoy the day.
Yeah. You too.
You've been listening to Habitat on CKDU 88.1 FM, habitatradio.ca, and rabble.ca/podcasts. Got feedback on the show? Call the CKDU feedback line at 494-8041 or email habitat@ckdu.ca or check us out on Twitter at Habitat Radio. I'm Erica Butler. Thanks for listening. Habitat.